All right, we are in the book of Acts. Well, kind of. A couple of words in, you know, whatever. Yesterday, what did we talk about? Primarily, we were talking about dating, correct? The date of the book, let me be more accurate. What in particular did we talk about yesterday regarding the date?
Before or after 66 AD.
Yes, that you can usually divide it into two major camps, before 70, after 70. So we talked mainly about the before 70 camp yesterday. Just give me some of the things that you remember from that conversation of arguing before 70 AD. Yes?
Mark and Luke have 48% overlap.
Yes, Mark and Luke have 48% overlap, which we'll talk about that even in more detail as we go along today. Yes. What date do they usually land on before 70 AD? 62. Why? Yeah, go ahead, just yell it out. Yeah, the argument from silence, which is what in particular? What is silent? Not written in Acts.
Just the abrupt ending.
The abrupt ending, because where is Paul whenever we end Acts? You might remember?
House arrest.
House arrest in Rome, which was around the date of 62 to 63. Hence their date, right? Therefore, what did they say? If that is the date, what would they suggest then as one of the possible options of why the book of Acts was written to begin with? Remember? Yes.
Paul was going on trial and it was written to defend him.
Maybe that's why it was written. It's his defense document as he stands before Nero with his lawyer reading it. Maybe we'll talk about maybe that's even who Theophilus was. We'll get to why I don't think that's legitimate. But where did I suggest that we should put the date of Acts? Go ahead, yell it out. After 70. And here's the reason why. The first one goes what we were talking about yesterday. Because the dating of the book of Acts is inextricably linked to the dating of the book of Luke, which is inextricably linked to the dating of the book of Mark, because of the 48% overlap, right? Therefore, the dating of Mark is essential for us to understand what the dating is of Acts. And ultimately, the essential point of dating is to allow us to understand what is going on at the time period, and that will impact the way in which we read the book as a whole. You see what I mean by that? Okay, and that'll become more clear as we keep going. When did I suggest that the book of Mark should be dated? After Peter's death. Why did I say that? Go ahead, yell it out. Yeah. Matter of fact, let me flip back to my notes from Mark, because I read it today in Mark. Eusebius, in ecclesiastical histories or church history, the history of the church, I guess it depends on the way you want to translate that, in 2:15, this is what he says about the Gospel of Mark. Listen to what he says. And so greatly did the splendor of piety illumine the minds of Peter's hearers. What does that mean? Peter was so holy that it overwhelmed the people that were listening to him as he preached. That they were not satisfied with hearing it once only. What does that mean? They wanted it more. But what's the problem? Peter may not be around much longer because he's going to be being killed soon. And we're not content with the unwritten teaching of the divine gospel. They had it in oral form, and that had lasted them for quite a while. But they weren't satisfied with that. Because the one that saw the stories to begin with is now going to be dying. And so he says, but with all sorts of entreaties, they besought Mark, a follower of Peter, and the one whose gospel is extant, that he would leave them a written monument of the doctrine which had been orally communicated to them. So they start going, they're going, Mark, please, just write. You've been taking notes. Put it into a book. Consider it a doctrinal monument or memorial of Peter. Nor did they cease until they had prevailed with the man, with Mark, and had thus become the occasion of the written gospel which bears the name of Mark. What was the occasion? Peter was about ready to die. And he's been preaching to the Roman Christians. And they're saying, we got to get this written down. Because look what Nero's done with all the other Christian leaders. What do you think he's going to do to him? We got to get this written down. Mark, please, please write it for us. Please get it down so that we can have it. Finally, Mark says, Peter, is that cool? Which this comes from another document. Is that cool? And Peter says, yeah, that's fine. The anti-Marcionite prologue is where that little part comes from, if we want to know. And then Peter says, okay, that's fine. Mark says, fine. And he then begins to write the document, organizes notes, which eventually becomes the Gospel of Mark, published after the death of Peter. So the external evidence is pretty solid on the dating of Mark. 67 to 70, which does what to our dating of Acts? It seems to push it after 70, doesn't it? Seems that way. As a matter of fact, there's even internal evidence in the Gospel of Mark that also seems to lend towards that understanding of the external evidence that kind of supports it. And this comes from Mark 13. Now, I know you're thinking, why are we talking about Mark to get to Acts? We're getting there. We're getting there. Mark 13. Does anybody know what's in Mark 13? No, haven't taken that class yet. Come on, someone with me. Mark 13 is a description of the destruction of the temple. It's paralleled in Matthew 24, and it's also paralleled in Luke 21. The first three Gospels all describe the destruction of the temple, every one of them. But what's interesting is that Matthew and Mark both describe the destruction of the temple in vague terms, while Luke is very specific. From a historian's perspective, not a theologian's perspective, a historian's, what would that suggest about Luke as opposed to Matthew and Mark?
He wrote it.
It seems to be that way, doesn't it? Matter of fact, let me read to you, I think. Yes. Let me read to you that you can hear the difference in the specificity between the two Gospels. Mark 13 says this. When you see the abomination that causes desolation standing where it does not belong, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So what does he say is going to happen? There's going to be a sign that we'll call the abomination of desolation. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know there will be one. But when you see it, and it'll be clear, get out of Dodge. So he's talking to the Christians in Jerusalem. Whenever you see the abomination of desolation, whatever that may be in Jerusalem, get out of Jerusalem because it's all coming down. But notice how vague it is in Mark. Now listen to Luke. Luke 21, 20 through 21. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies that are Roman, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Why? What sounds different there? What did you miss it? Go, yell. Yeah, it's pretty clear. He says, the sign will be whenever the Roman armies surround the city. Get out. Because its desolation, notice the words he used there, is near. It's going to happen. It almost sounds like that Matthew and Mark are pretty vague. Both of them, see, this is where somebody says, are you being anti-supernatural? No, I'm not. Because Jesus still predicted it before it happened. But the words he used doesn't give us the details that we desire. However, whenever we're past the fact, we can look back and say, well, that was the sign. And in fact, we do know that that is what happened. There was a Roman, matter, it was the 12th legion, Fulminata, known as the Thundering Legion, came from Caesarea whenever the rebellion started in 66, led by Cestius Gallus. And he comes from Caesarea, and he surrounds the city, and actually he breaks through the first wall. And they come in, I believe on the western side, they start coming in, and they get to the temple wall, and they actually start to set it on fire. And right before they set it on fire to wipe out the wall so they could go in and destroy the city, all of a sudden, Cestius Gallus inexplicably retreats. As a matter of fact, Josephus even says no one really knows why he retreated. He could have captured Jerusalem in 66, but he retreated. And he goes back to Caesarea, and on his way back, his entire legion is wiped out by the Jewish rebels. And Eusebius says that after that moment, that the Christians began to flee to Pella. Huh. That sounds an awful lot like what we have there, doesn't it? Luke 21, 20 through 21. Whenever the Romans surround the city, you know its desolation is near, so get out of Dodge. And that's what they did. Matter of fact, Josephus says that Jews, although he was probably talking about Christians, began to flee Jerusalem like a sinking ship. Why? Because they recognized the sign. So internal evidence even suggests what our external evidence about Mark's Gospel's date suggests as well. that it was written before the destruction of the temple, but possibly after the abomination of desolation. Okay. Okay. Then, let's look at the lack of literary cohesion. This is what seals the deal for me. Because at this point, you're sitting there going, okay, well then what's the possible purpose of the book of Acts if it's not for the defense trial in 62? If we push it past the time that Paul was killed, etc., what's its purpose? Well, this comes from the parallel that's interesting between the Gospel of Luke and in the book of Acts. Notice we talked about the lame man healings that are in both with Jesus and Peter and Paul. Remember that? The miraculous healings with the touching of the hem of the robe and the sweatbands and the shadows. Remember that? We talked about the parallels. Holler if you hear me. Nod. Help me. Okay. All right. There was also one other significant parallel that I mentioned that now I will make a bigger deal. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus goes and has five trials, of which he is found innocent in all five. Five. Guess how many trials that Paul has in the book of Acts?
Five.
And guess what? He's found innocent in all five of them. Now, if we have the parallels of Jesus' ministry and the parallels here with Paul's ministry, we have the parallels of even Jesus' trials and the parallels in Paul's trials, what are we missing as a key parallel from the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts? What's missing? What? The death, the resurrection, and the ascension. Aren't we missing that in Acts? There's no parallel to those, is there? Isn't that strange? That he would be so meticulous to make all these other parallels and then never get the parallel to the death, resurrection, and ascension? You'd think that'd be the one he's beeline towards, right? So what could be happening? What could be happening? Ooh, this is where it gets fun. First of all, though, let me respond to the pre-70 date arguments. They had three main ones I listed. One was that Acts was the defense argument before a court of law. One was that it's abrupt ending of Acts, therefore it can't be that abrupt. It needed to be longer, therefore that must have been the date in which it stopped. And the third was that there's too many details forgotten after AD 62. Those were the three arguments in favor of pre-70. You following me? I did those in reverse order than what I said to yesterday. Okay. Acts is a defense argument. That is weird. That the book of Acts was written as a part of the reason why was because Paul was on trial and they wanted to have a document that was 27% of the New Testament. That's a pretty long speech at the trial. Not unfounded in modern day, but that type of... let me ask you this question. Why would he go through all the trouble of the literary parallels if it's just a defense argument? What's the point of that? Just got bored? Yeah, you know, seriously, why are you making this artistic? Just make it provable. Number two, how many times in the book of Acts does Paul have someone speak at his trials for him? If Paul has the opportunity to preach the gospel before Nero, you think he's going to let a lawyer do that? Really? No way. Paul has a chance to talk. He's not going to let somebody talk for him, even if it is Luke. He's going to say, I got this. You sit down. Whatever you've written isn't even going to be as half as powerful as what the Holy Spirit's going to tell me to say. Doesn't that sound like Paul? So is it possible it was a document for his defense? It's possible. Is it probable? No. It seems a little bit weird knowing Paul and knowing how courtrooms actually work. Number two, their other argument was the abrupt ending of Acts. Here's the problem. Ancient documents end abruptly all the time. This wouldn't be the first time in the history of the annals of teaching that the book ended abruptly. Matter of fact, even something as famous and as influential as Homer's Iliad ends abruptly. It's a genre technique. It's something that even points to that which is beyond itself. So that, as one of you came up and told me, even your youth group said, we are called Acts 29 because we know the abrupt ending of Acts points to something future, something else. Right? Abrupt endings should not make us think that that's because that's when history stopped. It should make us think that maybe there's something else. The third thing they say, the forgotten details after AD 62, I agree, that is a problem. Because there's a lot happened in 62, like the death of Paul, the burning of the Christians in 64 after the burning of Rome, the death of Peter, the rebellion that began, that we should have documented those details. Right? Do you agree with that? I think so too. And that's why here is my solution. I think that the book of Acts is the second volume of a three-volume work. And we just don't have the third volume. What would be in the third volume? What do you think? If you're just dreaming with me, what would be in there? What? If you were Luke, and you get done with the second volume, and you knew you were going to write a third, what would you be writing about? Maybe the literary parallels of the death, the resurrection, and the ascension of Jesus. Right? And what better way to talk about the death of Jesus than to talk about the death of Paul and the death of Peter and the persecution of the Christians by Nero and the chaos that's erupting in the 60s, the 70s? Kind of sounds like the death of Christians, doesn't it? Oh, but when does the resurrection come for the Christians? At the destruction of the temple. Jesus made two major claims about the future. One of them was His second coming. One of them was the destruction of the temple. And one of them was going to happen before the second coming, and it's the only other one He said, and that's the destruction of the temple. The first three Gospels all talk about the destruction of the temple. It was a big deal. Why? Why would the destruction of the temple be a big deal for the Christians? What would it have accomplished? What?
Shows that God doesn't
know. Yeah. Because what do the Jews claim? The temple is where heaven and earth intersect. This is where God's presence is. It's not with you dirty Jewish sect known as Christians, little Christ, which actually we'll learn is used for the first time in Acts as a pejorative term, a way of putting them down. The temple is what has the presence of God, the power of God. That's where heaven and earth intersect, in the Holy of Holies. It's one of the reasons why whenever the high priest would go in there once a year, they would tie a rope around his leg. So if he died, they could pull him out because no one wanted to go in where heaven and earth intersect, especially if they were unclean. This is a national identity marker. This was a source of pride for the Jews. This is something that not only they worshipped at, I would even suggest it was a structure that they worshipped. You hear that? And all of a sudden, Jesus says, actually, I am where heaven and earth intersect. You want to know why Jesus calls Himself the temple? For my body is the temple, it will be destroyed, and I will raise it again. I will rebuild it in 3 days. Why does He say that? Because if the temple is defined as where heaven and earth intersect, and Jesus is the incarnated God in flesh, He then is where heaven and earth intersect. So, now let's take it even further into theology. Why does Paul call us the temple? The body of Christ. Yes.
Holy Spirit.
Yes. Because now we are where heaven and earth intersect. Because when the Holy Spirit is in you, you take God to people. The church is the temple because the church is where heaven and earth intersects now. In the destruction of the temple, as long as it was standing, the Jews had a one-up. But when it was destroyed, what did it do? It vindicated everything that was in the Gospel of Luke and validated everything that they were in the book of Acts. And wouldn't that be an incredible way of saying, even though we were dying in the 60s, we resurrected because Jesus was vindicated at the destruction of the temple. Ooh, that'll preach, friends. Yes?
I have a question about, why do you think the Jews would destroy the temple themselves?
This one was most fascinating, is the Jews, during 66 to 70, you're also dealing with an honor-shame society. How do you preserve honor when you know you've lost a battle? Old Testament, you'd kill yourself. Right? Matter of fact, in Masada, the very last stronghold in AD 73 of the Jewish revolt, the Romans had surrounded it for months, I believe around 21 months. And when they finally made it in, what they found was a whole bunch of dead bodies because they had poisoned themselves. The Jews inside of the temple didn't want to have happen with the Romans what happened with the Babylonians. For the Babylonians not only destroyed the temple, but they took all, according to Daniel 1, they took all the temple treasures out, and it began to be worship symbols inside of the pagan temples. And the Jews say, I will preserve the honor of myself and of my God by not only destroying the temple, but by killing myself.
So do you think God used them destroying the temple to also prove that? Like, it's interesting that, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and I would say yes and no. If you understand what a Jew was thinking at the time Jesus was there, their lust for violence was so out of control that it wouldn't have surprised God. God wouldn't have had to connect very, very many dots in order for that to happen. They were on that track anyway. The amount of Jew, the blood spilled by Jews of other Jews inside it. Matter of fact, that's one of the things that's interesting. Titus, the Roman general, tried to get them not to burn the temple down. But the Jews did burn it themselves because they don't want anybody to have it but them. It's their lust for violence and their desire for liberation against their enemies caused it even to something that to turn on themselves. And we'll talk about that more, especially when we get to the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus says, those who live by the sword die by the sword. Yeah, they'll even kill the other people that are on their side with the sword. It gets crazy. Yes?
Would you say if they were to find like the third volume of Acts that you put into the Bible?
No, it shouldn't. You want to know why? Because this canon was put down by my church fathers, by the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and I don't need anything else. Would it be an interesting document that I would study, maybe even try to write books on? You're darn right. It'd be really cool. But we don't need any other books. Do we? That's the question in and of itself, not you. Usually when the question is asked in a pejorative manner, so you mean the canon's not closed? What are you even talking about? What does that even mean? As if I don't have the complete revelation of God sitting in front of me. Do I think if we found the third book that it would say, and Jesus really didn't die, or he didn't really raise from the dead? No. It would say everything else the other book said, so why do I need it? So is the canon closed to me? The canon is the canon, as defined by my church fathers, that I trust because they were closer to the situation than I was anyway. If they had the book, they would have put it in. And you read some of the books that aren't in, they're crazy. Seriously, the Gospel of Thomas, which is huge in the historical Jesus movement, read the darn thing. You all of a sudden you'll be like, yeah, we got the right ones. We're good. As a matter of fact, ladies, sorry. The end of the Gospel of Thomas, though, says, if women want to make it into heaven, they must convert to males. I think we're okay. I think we're good. You see what I mean? This is one of the things where if you really want to alleviate the fear that you have of the other books that are out there, read them. Study them. And you'll realize we're good to go. We're good to go. Matter of fact, even if it was on the borderline, like the Shepherd of Hermes almost made it in. But there was a couple passages that were borderline and they said, you know what, better safe than sorry. Do I think that we have every letter that was ever written by every apostle? No. We even know in 1 Corinthians, Paul says, in my former letter, this says 1 Corinthians. There is no zero Corinthians. But Paul, it wasn't the only time Paul had ever written to the Corinthians. So does that mean we don't have the whole story? No! This is just the facts. You cannot become a Christian and be dedicated to Jesus Christ without some element of faith. You just can't. So if you're looking for Loctite scientific evidence, you will never fully dive into Jesus. Why? Because he doesn't work that way. A prerequisite of faith is mystery. And if you don't like mystery, you want to eradicate mystery, you eradicate the very thing that leads us to reliance on God in the first place. He purposely doesn't give us all the answers because we have to trust that what he is giving us is enough. But we don't want... This is the reason why in 1 Corinthians 13 it says, but we have faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Why is the greatest love? Because whenever we move to eternity, faith and hope no longer exist. Only love does. Because faith will be eradicated because now we'll be replaced with certainty because we'll be able to see God. And hope will have been realized because what we were hoping for we're now existing in. They're gone. But love, What we do down here with love is what we'll continue to do up there in love. So that may be the thing we should be the best at. Because we'll be doing it for a long time. Is this making sense? I mean, the third volume, probably, if you want to know my historical guess, Luke may have died before he finished it. It may not have ever even been completed. How do we know where he was at in his composition whenever he died? We don't. Therefore, my argument is that there was probably a third volume, at least conceptually. But whether or not we have it or not does nothing for our faith, because we've got the whole story. We don't need parallels to the death, resurrection in Jesus Christ, in the ascension of Jesus Christ, in order to know that he died and raised again and ascended. Do we? No. All it would do is continue to strengthen the faith of the Christians in the first century in the same way it strengthens ours. That's it. But guess what? I have 27 other books that can help me with that too. It's like I was teaching Revelation in Russia, and this guy was ticked off at me and just started yelling and rushing at me. And the interpreter was like, oh, and now he says you're this, and now he says that you're doing this. And then he would stop, and the interpreter, after he'd get done yelling, and the interpreter would look at me, and I would say, okay. And he's like, that's all you want to say? And I was like, what does he want me to say? I've already given my whole presentation. What does he want me to say? He obviously doesn't like me and what I'm saying, so that's cool. I still love him. He's a great guy. A little loud, but nice guy. Then the guy got really upset and he said, if what you're saying is right, then the book of Revelation is just like every other book in the New Testament. And I said, now him and I are on the same page. Why? Because these books reinforce the same message over and over and over from a different perspective. They are saying virtually the same thing because it's the same story that they're musing over. And yet what's interesting about the story is no matter how many words we pour into it, it's never enough to contain the true story because the story is bigger than what our words can contain. See how that works? It doesn't matter if we have another 27 books that we find. And guess what? It still won't give us the whole story because the story is beyond what we can contain. And yet, is what we have enough? Yeah. How do you know? What does know even mean, my friend? What does know even mean? You want to ask who I trust, I can answer that question. But if you want to know how I know with absolute certainty, well, you don't understand faith at that point. Not you, but that'd be the person I'd be talking to. You following me? Okay, so if there is a document that's legitimate that was not in our Bible, it doesn't mean you don't have a complete revelation of Jesus Christ. Right? He talks about it four different angles called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We need four more Gospels. Really? Really? We do? I'll just stick with these and then I'll study these. There's nothing wrong with that. It's one of the reasons why I don't have an allergic reaction to the Apocrypha. It actually is good history. Anyway. Okay. What would be the ascension parallel, though, for Christians? Here's what I think. If you have the death of the Christians paralleling Jesus in the third volume, the resurrection, the destruction of the temple, the ascension, I think would be the exhortation for the Christians. Where Luke would look at them and he would say, get out there, and even if it means you die, go witness. Why? Because your fate will be just like Jesus's. Because, buddy, whenever he died and rose again, guess where he went? He went to bliss. And if you die, you'll resurrect and you will ascend too. And all of a sudden, you have this beautiful work that begins with Jesus and it ends with Jesus. And all in between is the way in which we live out Jesus. It's what Jeff Snell calls changing Jesus to a verb. You see what that to me seems to make a little more sense. Also, sociologically speaking, the third volume, or the book of Acts, would make more sense in the 70s. Why? Because the craziness that was happening with the Jews in 66 to 70... didn't make the Romans like the Jews very much after 70. Does that make sense? You understand what I mean by that? I mean, hello. They caused a four-year war that within that time period, the Empire of Rome almost crumbled. Because in 69, we have four emperors that reign. Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian. Four in 1 year. Right in the middle of this revolt, and the revolt was one of the major problems. They couldn't hold all of the empire together when the whole empire was in flux. Romans didn't like the Jews too much after this. They weren't friends. And guess what? Romans didn't take the time to distinguish Christians from Jews all that often. Because Christians were just a sect of Judaism. Just Jews that believe something a little different. I don't care what they believe. They're a problem. So what the book of Acts could do in the 70s is say this. Listen, we come from Judaism, but we are not the way the Jews are. We're different. As a matter of fact, even one of our key leaders went before the Roman courts and was found innocent 5 times. Read the book. Acts in the middle of the 70s could be Christian propaganda to take to the Romans and say, you don't need to be persecuting us because even from your own mouths we're innocent. Makes much more sense in the 70s than it does in the 60s, I think, from a sociological perspective. So, what am I saying? The book of Acts was published in the mid-70s as the second volume of a 3-volume work, the last volume of which was never completed and or published. That's what I'm saying. And you, guess what? Guess what? Here's the reality. You can totally disagree with me. And we can both still be friends. But it does change the way we read the book a little bit. Doesn't it? In my former book, Theophilus. Who is Theophilus? We don't really know. But we have some guesses. First of all, though, and this might be a good test question, I don't know, just throwing that out there. The word Theophilus comes from 2 Greek words put together. The word theos, which means what? God. And the word philos, which means what? Love. Love, or brotherly love. Love, the lover of God. That's what the name Theophilus means, lover of God. So, as a result of that name, we have 3 different options of who this person could have been. Number 1, maybe he wasn't even a real person. Maybe it was just a name made up just so because he's writing the book to the people that love God. Is it possible? Sure. Is it probable? No. Why? Because that would just be such an unnecessary detail that Luke didn't have to put in order to get his gospel any sort of legitimacy to be read or his book of Acts. You see the issue there? Why make up a name? It's not necessary, Luke. If the guy's not real, just say, to all the Christians that love God. That's all you needed to say. Maybe he's just hung up on literary, or maybe there's better options. Number 2, maybe he was the lawyer of Paul that was going to be presenting the works before Nero. Well, you know what I think about that, right? I think we've talked about that a little. I don't know of when Paul needed somebody to speak for him, therefore it would be odd if this guy named Theophilus was speaking for Paul whenever Paul never would let anybody speak if he could speak himself. Even if the whole city was inside of an amphitheater like Ephesus and they're chanting, "Greatest Artemis of the Ephesians," what did Paul want to do? Send in my lawyer! No. He's like, let me in. No, don't go in. They'll tear you apart. I don't care. I want to talk to him. That's Paul. Okay? No lawyer is going to be talking to him, especially to Nero. Hello? Number 3. He was the patron of the book, Theophilus. And this is where I land. Why? The word most excellent is a title that's given to Theophilus in Luke 1:1. Most excellent Theophilus. This is a title that was normally used for governors or equestrians, people of nobility. And with the nobility comes what economically? What? Money. Wealth. These are wealthy people. Most excellent was a term that usually referred to not just status, but monetary provision. And in the ancient world, publishing was not cheap at all. The material was not as accessible as what we have paper today. It just wasn't. And even the skill of someone that was writing it was not easily found either. It was a profession. And if you wanted it copied multiple times, you'd have to hire multiple scribes to copy it multiple times, and they would get paid by the hour and by each of the documents that they complete. Very expensive. And Luke was a doctor, but doctors in the ancient world were not rich like doctors today. Matter of fact, doctors were slaves. Which is one of the reasons why whenever we see the shipwreck, that they assume that Paul is of prominence because he's got multiple people with him that are following him, an entourage, and one of them is a doctor. He must be his slave. Therefore, the doctor couldn't have foot the bill himself. He would have needed somebody to foot the bill for him, and that's what we call a patron. Somebody that says, I'll pay for it. And I think that that's the most logical understanding of who Theophilus is. Why? Because this happened all the time. Matter of fact, in the book Sylvi by the author Statius, he writes 5 books of poems. And let me read you the beginning of some of those books so that you can get an idea of what I'm talking about when I'm saying patrons. Book 1, Statius writes this. He says, "Much and long have I hesitated, most excellent Stella. Distinguished as you are in your chosen area of our pursuits, whether I should assemble these pieces, which stream from my pen in the heat of the moment, a sort of pleasurable haste, emerging from the bosom one by one, and send them out." Stella is the person paying for the book to be published. It's both written for Stella, and it's both paid for by Stella. It's paid for and written for. Same thing in book 2. "Such is our friendship that is my joy, most excellent Melior, elegant in your literary judgment, no less than in the whole color of your life." Ridiculous. Book 3. "To you at least, dearest Polyus, most deserving of the tranquility to which you are so faithfully cling, I do not have to justify the temerity of these little pieces." What's he doing? He's sucking up, acknowledging the patron, the person that's footing the bill. That's always a good thing to do, except you will have this in the church, and this is how we'll end. This is an important thing for you to learn. In the church, you will have people that because they give money, they think that they can control and change doctrine. Happens all the time. Matter of fact, here's an important principle. The person that is the richest in the congregation, you need to have it, and I hate to tell you this, but this is reality. You need to be the most skeptical of. Because it's happened, every ministry I've been in, it's always happened, where the person that was the richest in the congregation at some point looks at me and they say, "Do you know how much money I give to this church?" You know what my response back is? I don't care. Because if you leave, I trust that God will bring somebody even richer. Or maybe a 10 people that match how rich you are. His wallet's bigger than yours. Sorry. I'm just not going to bow down to what you say. One of the guys actually wanted me to go before our congregation because it was found out that this guy had AIDS. And the rich guy was really upset that we hadn't told, we knew about it, but we weren't telling everybody. He was so mad. He wanted us the next Sunday to bring the guy forward and tell everyone that he had AIDS so that everybody could kind of steer clear. And I looked at him and I said, "No, unless you want to give up and start listing all the sins you've ever done in your life, and then we follow by every other person in the room." "Well, no, you need to realize, Shane," is what he told me, "that you can't believe every single rule that's in the book written in the 1800s. It's like, "Sir, the Bible was not written in the 1800s. Whatever. And he said, "Well, if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, I'm going to leave." And I said, "Sir, it's been good serving you." You can't compromise the truth, even for a patron. Just can't do it. And Luke doesn't either. But we'll get to that next week. Love you guys.